Hi, y'all. I'm Jennifer White, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date's June 24th, 2007. My home group is Simple Solution Group in Moorhead, Kentucky. We meet at Mondays at 6 o'clock. It's a small group. If you're ever passing through Eastern Kentucky, you're always welcome. I gotta get rid of this pen or I'll stop playing with it. I've got a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I've got a great sponsee family, and a lot of them are, my sisters are here to support me tonight, and that's an incredible feeling. I'm grateful that I was able to come and do this. I actually didn't know that I was even gonna come to the mountain until about 2 hours before John called. And so I was told to never say no, and this is what I do today. This is what I was taught to do. And so I appreciate the offer. I was thinking earlier today, when I first came to Mont Eagle, it seemed to me like we had different chairs, and it just seemed like the whole room was filled. And my first time here, I was 10 months sober, and we did that countdown, and I remember thinking, okay, but it's like, what, 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, and I'll be a year. Can I not just stand up because I'm almost a year? I don't want people to know that I only have 10 months. And that's the story of my life, you all. Me trying to be somewhere I'm not. Me trying to fear your all's perception of me. So that I think all of a sudden, if I've got 12 months of sobriety, you're going to think better of me than if I've got 10 months of sobriety and judge me differently. You know, that's that crazy, sick thinking that is my isms that I really think I came out of the womb with. I was always concerned with everybody's perception, always concerned with how can I live up to what I thought your perception of me was, even as a child. My parents were real young when I was born. They were 18 and 19. And when they got pregnant, they dropped out of college. My dad joined the police force with the state police, and my mom took a small job, and they moved in with his parents. I think that kind of started a family dynamic then that I wasn't aware of until years and years and years later. But in that household, my mom was real young, and she had grown up in an alcoholic family and didn't feel like she had much self-esteem or much power or much control. And then here she is moving in at 18 years old with a new baby into her in-laws' house. And in that house, there was some dysfunction there too. There wasn't alcohol, but there was dysfunction. And when I was two, we moved out of that house into our own house. And I have got a little brother. He's 3.5 years younger than I am. I say little. He's like 6'4", 250 pounds. He's this huge firefighter, but he'll always be my little brother. And I was the person in the family that my dad was gone a lot because of his job. He ended up working eventually as an undercover narcotics agent for the state police. And that gets real funny, and we'll get into that later. I remember him being gone a lot because he was on the other side of the state and he was in some real dangerous territory, and we just weren't allowed to be there. But he came home, and you know, my mom did the best that she could, but I spent a lot of time between both sets of my grandparents. And so I had this alcoholic family on one side, I had these young parents that were just trying to figure it out in one part, and then I had this other set of grandparents who, my grandmother's from Germany, so that was a whole different culture, and my grandfather was a drill sergeant, and that came through in every aspect of his life. And so, you know, all these men that I kind of felt like, I mean, from little, that I had to be the one to control everybody else's emotions, to keep everything else in check in all of my families. You know, I had to go over to the alcoholic household and think about, is Grandpa drinking today? What's Grandpa drinking? How's Grandpa acting? How do I take care of my little brother? How do I manage all of this? How do I go over to this household and remember all my German customs, and what do I call her, and what do I do over here? And then when I get home, you know, what do I do there? And that was that chameleon that just started. I mean, from the very, very, very beginning. And I couldn't handle when anyone got upset. For some reason, I always thought it was me because I never felt okay in my own skin. I never felt like I was doing everything right. So I always felt like when somebody got upset, it was because of something I did. it was because of something I said or I didn't do. And I saw the ripple effect through everybody. If one person got upset in my family for whatever reason, there was a ripple. And I didn't like that ripple. And I always tried to control that. My entire life, when I was 10, we moved from this small town into just outside of Louisville, just outside of the city, and I didn't know much about the city, and the area that my parents moved to was actually the richest part in Kentucky, and I didn't know anything about money, and it was a culture shock. It was a huge, huge culture shock. I instantly did not fit in. But because of my perception of how everyone else treated me and me never wanting to be less than, I lied and lied and lied and lied and told you whatever you needed, I thought you needed to hear, so that you thought I fit in, you know, so that I was trying to keep up with the Joneses, just trying to make friends. And it was this vicious cycle that just took hold. I couldn't manage it for long. And that feeling of discontent, that feeling deep down in my gut of never being okay in my own skin, always feeling wrong-sized. You know, I was either better than when I would go back to the country because I was hanging out with all these rich people, or I was less than when I was with these rich people. You know, I was never right-sized, no matter how I acted or what I did. And in that, I started searching for some ease and comfort at a fairly young age. I remember being, and at the time I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I just knew that I was uncomfortable. And I was sick a lot as a kid, and I remember going to the doctor, and the doctor would give me medication and I would feel better, and I'd get to skip school for a while, and the whole world just kind of got quiet. And I really liked that feeling. And before I knew it, when my world got real loud again, because I couldn't control everything or anyone in it, I would start faking asthma attacks, faking being sick, so I could go to the doctor again. And he would give me medicine, and I'd get a week off of school, and I'd be okay again. You know, and that was all just me not feeling okay in who I was. No idea at all that was my disease. You know, that was, because I'd never had a drink at that point. I don't ever remember my first drink. I remember my grandfather thinking it was real cute for me to sip off of his beer and sip off of his whiskey, and thinking it was real cute to drive up to the liquor store and send me in with his money. And so I kind of thought that was real cool, you know, to do those things for my grandfather. But I don't ever remember my first drink. What I do remember is at 13, I'd been off of school for a little bit, and the popular cheerleader asked me if I wanted to come spend the weekend at her house. I don't even remember ever having a conversation with her at all before this. I don't even know how I knew her, how this even happened, but I remember telling her, yeah, and I can steal some beer. I don't even think I'd had my first drink at that point, but I wanted to fit in, and I wanted some ease and comfort because she made me nervous. For some reason, I thought that was going to make it okay, that we were going to connect over a drink, because that's what I'd seen all my life, right? All these adults, all of a sudden, you know, I spent a lot of time around parties, and they all come in and they're talking, and then after a few drinks, everything just kind of mellowed out, and you know, I thought that's how it worked at 13. So I went to school. I was going to go spend the weekend with her, and I stole some beer from my parents and put it in my locker in my eighth grade middle school, and I thought that was okay. You know, and I thought she wasn't going to say anything, and it was going to be our secret. And about halfway through the day, I start seeing all these police cars roll up at school. I'm like, wonder why they're here. And then dogs start coming around and sniffing, and wonder what they're doing. Oblivious that I had even done anything I wasn't supposed to do. And next thing I know, they're pulling me in for school and into the principal's office. And there's this policewoman there. And she said, I hear you've got beer. You've got liquor on property. Well, actually, it wasn't in my locker. So, of course, being the good, you know, person that I was, no, it's not. I hear it's in somebody else's locker. I didn't have anything to do with it. I'm 13, and this police officer, this woman, takes me and pushes me up against the wall. And she said, "Do you think drinking makes you feel like a woman?" I just wanted to fit in. I never thought about it. And then she got in my face and started yelling at me for having this alcohol. And my first response is, "Do you not know who my father is?" Yeah. She knew who my father was. You know, the thing is I was in the process of being in eighth grade, not sure if I'd ever quite had my first drink or not, but I was planning it. I mean, there was that process, that mental obsession. I had my weekend planned. I knew what I was going to do. I was being arrested at 13 years old in my dad's police district. Yep. That's how my parents found out that I liked alcohol. There were several other people involved with me because there were some other things that kind of went down. And my dad came in, and my dad took me, and the police took all the other kids. And I remember being upset, and I remember being in the back of his police car, and I remember driving to the police station and seeing all those other people in the police station. And I got to stay outside in my dad's police car. Well, he went in and did something and then came home, and all I knew was I was grounded and that I had to go to court. But everyone else was in a lot more trouble than I was, and I was the one that brought the liquor in. So I felt real powerful. You know, whether I'd had that drink or not, there was something about all of that I got a lot of attention from, and I really enjoyed that. And I didn't see my dad a whole lot up until that point. And I remember him grounding me and telling me that I had to, I had played soccer, and that I had to get my referee's license because he was a soccer referee, and that was going to keep me out of trouble because every Saturday morning he could keep an eye on me. He would know exactly where I was, and he was going to keep his eye on me. I said, "Okay, I will go and I will pass this test and I will be a soccer referee." And in all of this time, I had turned 13, and I remember him coming to me because he wanted to bond at this point. Now I was getting in trouble and he was getting concerned about his little girl. And he came up to me and he said, "You know, you're 13. Why don't I take you out and we'll go out to dinner and I'll take you dancing and we'll go shopping and we'll just have a nice father-daughter day." And I looked at him and I said, I don't want to be with you. I don't know you. I don't like you. I'm not going to be seen in public with you. Which is normal teenage stuff. But today I realized what I did was I crushed that man's spirit. I hurt that man on that day. And I didn't want to have anything to do with him for years after that. But I did what he told me to do. I went and I refereed soccer. And at this point, I'd been drinking. I had started drinking kind of on the weekends. And then it was all weekend. Then it was me sneaking out of the house for a couple of hours, drinking, coming back in an hour before I had to be refereeing soccer somewhere. Dad not understanding why I'm sitting on the sideline with a flag, can't run up and down the field with him. You know, it's because I'd been out drinking all night. Had switched into high school and started drinking on a daily basis by this point. I was sleeping through class all day long because I was drunk all night long. I was going from one class to the next class to the next class. All of my friends had changed. My grades were dropping. And one day, I stole my parents' car in the middle of the night. I'd never driven a car before in my entire life, and I decided it was a good idea because they left the garage door open that night, right? So it's their fault. I had that invitation. And I, right? Because it's really okay to do those things, that justification, you know, that constantly came with me. And I stole their car that night, went out, and totaled it. But drivable, you know, that it's right at that totaled line where the insurance company is going to tell you they need to replace that car, but you can still limp it home. And I limped it home and I put it in the garage. And I had gotten in trouble in school the night before, so we were supposed to go meet the principal the next morning, you know, but I'd been out drinking and wrecking their car. But my brother at the time was shorter than me, and I thought, I got it. I can adjust the seats and adjust the mirrors. So I adjusted the mirrors down, and I pulled the seat all the way up, and I went in and went to bed and got up with my alarm went off and got dressed like nothing had ever happened. And, you know, Mom got me, and we walked out to the car, and she lost it. And she says, "Have you seen my car? Oh, my gosh, what happened?" I'm like, "What's wrong? What are you talking about, Mom?" And the car was totaled. And she gets in and she's like, something's wrong. My seat's pushed up. The mirrors are wrong. And I said, oh, I bet Kevin took your car out last night, Mom. I'm blaming it on my 12-year-old brother. But she bought it. And then we went in the principal's office that day, and it was the first time I'd ever technically skipped school. And I'd gotten in trouble that day, and it was like these consequences. You know, all of a sudden I went from I've never had a drink to I've been arrested without maybe even having a first drink to drinking on a daily basis, skipping school, drinking all night long, hanging out with people. I mean, I'm 14 years old, and I'm hanging out with guys that are over 20. Over 21, because they're the ones that can buy my alcohol. You know, that's scary if you think about it in today's terms. You know, I was really, really, really lucky. God had been watching me from a really long time. And it was during that same week when all of my consequences just kind of came down, crashing down on me all at once, that I had a total psychotic break in the middle of class, right between classes, actually, in the hallway one day. And my parents came in and they said, what's going on? And I just told them everything. Well, my mother had been at this point, had admitted that her father was an alcoholic and had been going to adult children of alcoholics for a while. And she'd been working with somebody that was in recovery and knew some teenagers in recovery. And she said, we're okay. We have this therapist. We're going to send you to this therapist. I work with a girl that's not that much older than you, and she's an AA, and we're going to send you to these meetings, and it's all going to be great. I said, okay, I'm willing to do that. You got to pull me out of school. We'll homeschool you. We'll do whatever it takes. Great. And I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and at that time it was October of 1987. And she put me in this great group. There was a really awesome group of young people at that time. And I would think I was just done. I hit my bottom real early because I hit it real hard. And I hung out with these people, and we went to meetings. And, yeah, there was these old-timers that said those things that, you know, all the young people hear, that they've spilled more on their tie than I drank. And I just ignored them because I had all these new friends, and they were sober. And the longer I spent time with them, the more privileges my parents started giving me back and the more freedom I had. And I switched schools, and I had friends that were sober in that school. And I did really, really well for a couple of years. When I first gave my talk, this time when I got sober, I would have told you I had 5 years sober, because denial runs thick with me. There was one night when I went out and drank, and it was probably around this time of the year, if I remember correctly, because I'm from Louisville, so Derby, I remember Derby festivities, and I remember going out and drinking one night, and I remember lying to my parents and telling my parents, I've got this friend, and she's in AA, and she's in trouble, and I'm not going to come home tonight, and I'm not going to go to school, because I need to go help her. And I went out, and I drank for one night, and I didn't tell anybody, and I went back to school the next day, and met up with my AA friends, and acted like it never happened, and pushed it all the way in the back. And kept coming around for a couple of years. You know, the problem was, is I'd meet them, and we'd go to this great game room, and we'd hang out, and we'd do things, and I'd go to meetings. And we'd meet up, and we'd do these fun things, and I'd go to meetings. I'd seen this thing called a big book, and I'd kind of heard something about it. I think I owned one, but I would have told you I'd never read it. I never understood it. Never applied to me, because I was doing great. So I got sober when I was 15, and then when I was about 18, one of the other girls that was in the program, because some of them were older now, and they were starting to go to bars and hear bands after the meeting, said, I'll give you my fake ID, because that's a real sober thing to do, isn't it? So now I could go out with all my sober friends to the bar, and so we'd go to a meeting, and then we'd go to the bar. We'd go to the meeting, we'd go to the bar, and hear these bands. Yeah, you all know what's coming, right? So we did that for a while, and then there was a few of us, and we all kind of decided one day, you know, maybe it was just a teenage phase we were going through. maybe, you know, every kid drinks, and if you had alcoholics in your family, like we have in our family, and, you know, all those excuses we make to drink in the first place, because I was just going to meetings, and I wasn't really running a program, and I hadn't started my steps, and three of us one night said, you know, those wine cooler things are new, and we haven't tried those yet, so there's this party, let's go do that. And that's what we did. Three of us that had been sober for years in AA together, going to meetings and hanging out, went to this party. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday. We all each sat in a corner and looked at each other like, who's going to drink first? What's going to happen if we drink, you know? And I had that wine cooler that night, and it was on. It was on. I didn't go back to AA. We didn't tell anybody anything. At this point, you know, I had all these other people that were partying and going to the bars that I'd already met, and it was real easy just to switch that whole support system again. And that's what I did. And I went back to those old friends, and it was no time flat that I was back drinking every single day. And then I'd been dating this guy for a while, and he kind of knew about my past, and I kind of got happy for a minute and was able to put the bottle down. There was probably a couple years there where I didn't drink at all and got married and thought that everything was going to be okay now because I was older and I was wiser and I was more mature and I could handle this, and now I'm married and managed to graduate high school, barely, and, you know, life just happened. We were married for about 3 years. We were young. He got into an accident and became permanently disabled, and all of a sudden, the whole world came down on me again, and I did what I do. You know, I'm uncomfortable. I can't manage life anymore. Nobody understands what I'm going through. You would drink if I drank. You know, you would drink if you went through what I went through. And it started small. It started with that justification stuff again, you know. I'm just going to cook dinner and have some wine. Turned into like this 10-course meal with a whole box of wine. yeah. And then it got to the point where that husband would say to me, why don't you just go have a drink? Because at least you're happier and you're easier to live with when you're drinking. Well, okay, why not? You know, I thought I'd had it all together. You know, from the outside, I always thought I had it together. I always had a job. I always had multiple jobs. You know, I thought I suited up and showed up when my family needed me. I was around. That was the truth. You know, I had a marriage, I had a house, I had a business, I had a car. You know, from the outside, I thought, there's no way I look like an alcoholic. So alcohol cannot be my problem. But I was dying on the inside, you all. Dying. Every single day, every single minute. And it never once did it dawn on me that it was that alcohol again. Because that was just that phase that I still believed. It was that delusion and that denial that I had told myself all those years ago. You know, I didn't have a trouble with alcohol. And my life was miserable. I became suicidal. I cheated on my husband and thought it was okay because all I did was lie. Thought it was okay because I told him that that's what I was going to do. That delusion that we all get into. You know, some people say that when they got sober, they don't know what it was like to take a sober breath. I didn't know what it was like to take a truthful breath. My lies had lies had lies had lies with everybody in my family towards the end. And one day, I had gone to a conference with somebody from my business, and he was in Al-Anon. And it was 15 hours away from my house, and I was completely suicidal. I was buying every self-help book. I shared this in the meeting the other night because it wasn't my alcohol, so it had to be something else. Every self-help book trying to diagnose myself with whatever mental condition, because if you can just tell me what I have, I can fix this. if you can just tell me that I need a pill, right? Tell me I'm bipolar. Tell me I'm something so that we can just get on with this. And I think in the back of my mind, I thought, don't tell me I'm an alcoholic. I can't be that because then I don't have a quick fix. And I went on this trip and fell apart mentally, spiritually, emotionally. There was nothing left. I remember laying on the floor of this hotel room just crying and calling my mom and saying, I don't know what's going on with me. Maybe my medication for something else is off. You know, maybe it's my hormones. Maybe I need to have something tested. You know, any and every excuse. And on the second night of this conference, a bunch of us went out to this to dinner at a brew pub. And I ordered a beer, and I hadn't drank in a couple of days, and I didn't like beer. This was the best beer I've had in my entire life. I drank it down, and all I did was sit there the entire dinner and ask other people to order a drink. Sure you don't want another drink? You sure you don't want to? Some guy bought a gallon to take home with him to sip on through the whole week that we were going to be there. I'm like, but surely you need one more tonight. And it was somewhere in that night that it dawned on me. You know, I'd love to be able to tell you all that I had this big blowout, you know, of my last drink, and it wasn't. It was one drink. It was one drink of me sitting there with a bunch of people who were normal drinkers and me thinking, oh my gosh, I'm an alcoholic because I remember in AA before, you know, when you couldn't drink alone or when you couldn't have just one or when you were trying to get everybody else to drink so you could drink more. It was that obsession that was on me that entire week. And that was my last drink. That was June 23rd, 2007. I went through DTs with these people and didn't tell them what was going on. I was miserable, stuck in Duluth, Wisconsin. And with nobody, because at the time I was still stuck in that, if I tell you I'm an alcoholic, you're going to judge me differently. Because I think that my window dressing looks real good and my life looks real together. I'm a massage therapist by trade, and I had one client, actually two clients, that I knew were in AA. You know, and it's funny because they would come and they would tell me that they were in the program, and I would say, oh yeah, you know, I used to do that. And right, you know, and they were just as loving and okay with that, and okay, you know, but they knew, you know. I mean, I can remember days where I couldn't keep my emotional nature together so bad that I would intentionally have my clients on their stomachs the entire time because all I was doing was crying because I couldn't hold it together because I needed that drink. And I couldn't have that drink because I couldn't smell like alcohol because then my clients would know. And on the way back from Duluth, I called those two women. And I said, I think I need to go to a meeting. The husband that I was with, I had separated with probably about a year and a half before this had happened. And neither one of those women answered the phone that day. And as soon as I got back home, I went to my meeting. Now, the funny thing about the meeting that I went to, you see, all these years that I was doing all of this drinking, I lived five houses away from a clubhouse. Five houses away. Every single day, I drove by that thing multiple times and thought, those people. Those people. And so full of myself. I remember walking into a meeting that night, and there was a woman there, and it was a women's meeting. And I walked up and I introduced myself and kind of told her, you know, that I'd been out for about 15 years since the last time I was sober. And she said, wow, you really need to share this with these women tonight. You know, this is really important. And my head got huge. And I thought, okay, all right, I'm important now all of a sudden. You know, it was that ego pride thing. And I sat in that meeting and judged those women all through that entire hour. And afterwards, one of them came up and handed me her number, and I looked down at it, and she was from a different part of town than I was originally from, because, you know, I was living in a kind of a seedy part of town at this point. But in my mind, I was still that rich girl living in that rich part of the town. And she handed me her number, and she shared that she'd been in jail, and you know, she had custody issues. And that didn't apply to me at all. And I thought, I'm not calling her. She didn't have anything. And I threw her number away on the way home. And when I got home, those two women that I had called both called me. And they said, sorry, we weren't there tonight. Let me come pick you up. Do you need me to come over right now? I said, I'm good. I'm good right now. And okay, well, here's the meeting that they both went to the same meeting that Tuesday night. Here's this meeting. This is where we're going. Let me come pick you up. I'm like, I'll drive myself. All right, I needed to get away in case it wasn't right, in case it didn't feel right, in case I changed my mind. Because while I felt okay with them, I didn't feel okay with you all. And I drove myself to that meeting, and they were there. And they introduced me to all these wonderful people that accepted me and loved me. But I walked in with such ego and pride because I still had to keep that window dressing. I still had to try to convince you all that I had it all together. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I still have my job and my business, and I still own a car, and I'm not that low bottom drunk, which was the delusion, because the truth was, all I wanted to do was put a bullet in my head. The only thing that truly got me to that meeting when I was detoxing in Duluth, because all I wanted to do was die, was the thought of my mother looking over my casket and her heart being broke. And it's the only reason I think I made it into these rooms again, was that thought. I went to that meeting that next night, and I walked out of there, and I didn't get any more women's numbers, but I had those two. And then I had a God moment as I'm walking through that door. I heard God's voice, and I heard, you have got to reduce the size of your head, or you're going to die. And I thought, okay, I've got to do something different. And I went to a meeting every single night that week. And on that Sunday, there was a spitfire redhead that got on my last nerve. Because she was just like me. She was rude, and she was loud, and she was taking my inventory and in my face. And I hadn't quite filed those divorce papers, and we were leaning up against the car after we'd gone out to dinner one night, and she looks at me and she says, when are you going to stop using him and everybody else in your life? And I thought, well, how dare she? Next thing I know, I'm asking her to be my sponsor. At the time, it was the right decision because I needed somebody that saw me. I needed somebody that was as quick-witted and as smart-mouthed and as hard-headed as I was. And she proceeded to knock the bricks off of me for several months. I remember she told me that I had to get with this thing called God. Well, I didn't grow up in a religious household. My grandmother went to church religiously. I wasn't baptized, and she cried constantly thinking that I wasn't going to make it to heaven. So that's what I believed, was that because my parents didn't baptize me and I didn't belong to a religion, that I'm not going to heaven. However, when I did go to church with her, because it wasn't that my parents didn't tell me I couldn't go to church, I was allowed to go anywhere and explore any religion I wanted to. Somebody had to come pick me up and take me. That's the way that worked. But every time I went to anybody's church or anybody's religion or any exposure to God, I literally had to sit on my hands, or my grandmother would make me sit on my hands, because I would raise my hand, even as a little kid, in the middle of the sermon, and I'd want to argue with the preacher. Yeah, but. Or, I saw you do this. How can you get up here and then say that? I mean, from a little kid, those things didn't mix with me. So when you all said God, I said, no thanks. But then I remembered that if I didn't do something, I was going to die. So I agreed with that sponsor that, you know, she told me to go stand in the corner on my head. That's what I was going to do. And she broke the steps down to me, and she explained to me that it was my conception of my God. not anybody else's conception, not my grandmother's conception, my mom's conception, or anybody else's conception. And I thought, well, I can take that word because it's easy to talk about. It's a word that we can all kind of relate to. But I was just this real hippie chick, y'all, when I first got sober. And I believed in the trees, and I believed in Mother Nature, and there was this goddess in my idea. And so I'm like, okay, I've got to hold on to something. So that's kind of what I held on to in the beginning. It was just this free-flowing, you know, in my mind, it was a female. It was more like Mother Nature because I couldn't explain how the trees bloomed. I couldn't explain how the flowers came up or the grass grew or the wind blew, or that all had to be bigger than me. And that's where I started. And that was enough. That was enough for me to walk in these rooms and go, may or may not have this thing. I'm going to die if I don't try. You tell me I have to have this God thing. So, that was my willing to believe in something bigger than me. I'd been running around telling a four-step to anybody who would listen before I got sober, because I'm dying on the inside. I'm in so much pain. I just want it all to come out. So when you all told me I had to do the four-step, I'm like, no problem. Let's get to it. Except I'd just been doing the first column, the second column, and the third column because I didn't have any part in anything. It was everybody else's fault and everybody else's problem. Till I got to that fourth column, and that wasn't the truth. I got about halfway through that four step, and something happened, and I realized that I could no longer keep the same sponsor. And that was real scary for me. I had to switch sponsors halfway through writing my four step, and I went back to those same women, and then one other woman that I'd gotten close to in AA, and said, here's what's going on, and I think I need a new sponsor. And all of them said, let me pray about it. And every single one of them came back to me the next day and gave me the exact same name of a woman that I hadn't seen since I was sober 15 years prior, that they didn't even know that I knew from 15 years ago, because she was about 2 years older than me and we hung out together. But she'd stayed sober this whole time, and I had. So they told me where to go and find her, and I went up to her and I told her what was going on, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said she would. And just a couple of weeks later, we're sitting in my apartment and we're doing my fifth step. And there were a couple of things on my inventory that I was going to my grave with. I was never speaking about them. They were not coming out of my mouth. They were not even written on my fourth step. Because I can tell God, but I wasn't about to tell another human being. They were things so guilt and deep down that were killing me. And we spent the entire day. I remember my first four step was 120 pages. God love her. She spent 12 hours listening to me. We stopped. We had meals in the middle. We stopped and went to a meeting in the middle of my four step. I was going to tell her everything. I needed not to die is what I needed, except for those two things. At the very end of that night, she looks at me and she says, is there anything else you'd like to tell me? And my head said, nope, and I was getting ready to come out of my mouth, and the next thing I know, those things are coming out of my mouth. And I'm trying to stop them, you know? It's like, you want to shove them back in or something? And it wasn't happening. And she looked at me and she said, yeah, that happened to me too. I thought, wow, okay, we can do this. We went through the steps, and I got to 8 and 9. That's where I got scared. It was that pride. I still had that pride and ego at that point, and I did not want to go and tell anybody I was wrong. I messed up. And then have to do that and shut my mouth and hear whatever anybody wanted to say. So that was difficult, and I really thought my parents were going to be the hardest ones to do. So I did them last, and I did them together because it was pretty much the same stuff. And I sat in their living room, and I told them, and my mom said, I'm so glad you're sober. And my dad says, so this comes with a restitution thing? And I said, yeah, Dad, this is what I did, and this is my part, and I'm willing to do whatever. Oh, great. You mean you're going to replace that car you totaled? Yeah, Dad, if that's what you want me to do, I will replace that car that I totaled. And he said, no, I just want you to get healthy and well. I said, great. Okay. I went to my brother, you know, because I still thought I had that facade of everything looked good. And I went to my brother and sister-in-law. My brother goes, thank God you're an alcoholic. I was wondering when you were going to go get your life together. You know, everybody knew except for me. Check my time. Sobriety has given me great, great, great gifts. At 3.5 years sober, I got a lot of my stuff back, you know, because the truth was is I had driven my business into the ground just about, and the material stuff had really started to come back, and I was really active, and I thought, you know how we were all, I don't know if y'all were told, I was always told don't pray for patience in this program, so I didn't pray for patience, but what I do remember saying to God several times is, God, I just wish the world would stop so I can catch up. Let me tell y'all, don't pray for that either. 3.5 years sober, I got into a massive car accident. And the world stopped. That's not quite what I had planned. And the doctors didn't know if I'd ever be able to do massage again. They didn't ever know if I'd have complete and full use of my right hand again, my right arm again. I didn't know what I was going to do. And scared to death. And God put an opportunity for me to go back to school, to go back to college at 40 years old as a freshman. But I always believed I wasn't good enough to go back. It's why I'd never done it before. I'd always wanted to. But I didn't believe, even sober, that I was smart enough or I was good enough. And that opportunity got presented in front of me. And I went to go get my transcripts. I was 1 point from graduating high school with a C. I'd gone to college there for a while. But the thing with college is you actually have to show up or you have to withdraw. And I kind of didn't do either. So my transcript was a 0.71 GPA, and for any of y'all that don't know what that means, wow. that's below failing. It's real hard to come back from. But I applied to Morehead State, and they turned me down. And I thought, well, God, everything lined up, and I thought this is what I was supposed to do. I forgot one point. In all of this, I had gotten into a relationship, and this person, my husband now, moved to Morehead. And so after a year and a half of dating and recovery, I moved to Morehead too. So now I had the opportunity. That's part of why I had the opportunity to go to this college. And everyone talked me into appealing that decision, so I appealed it. And I had to sit in front of a whole board, and they said, this doesn't make sense. You know, you were really good here, and then you were really bad here, and you were really good here. And I said, they were looking at my transcripts. And I said, we don't understand. I said, oh, it's real simple, sober, drunk, sober, drunk, sober, drunk. Because that's what my college transcripts look like. And they gave me an opportunity to come back to school. I was on probation. I wasn't real happy about that because, you know, I'm sober and had been sober for 3.5 years. I didn't need to be on probation, but they put me on probation. And God has continued to open those doors for me. I'm not done yet, but I'm doing the next thing that's in front of me, one moment at a time. This week, I was inducted into PsychHI, which is the International Honor Society in Psychology. My GPA currently, after working so hard to get it up, is in the top 30% of that university. When I got sober and people used to say, you don't get here from there, I didn't understand that. I'm like, yeah, y'all do. You just work and you do and you get there. No, I get that today. You know, you don't get here from there. I have a wonderful home group. I sponsor wonderful women. I'm the GSR of my home group. Our district is dark right now because we live in a real small area in eastern Kentucky. And the area has asked me to come and maybe step up on a larger scale. I'm praying about it and talking with my wonderful sponsor about that. But, you know, that's another opportunity I wouldn't have before. I have a wonderful marriage today. I have a healthy marriage today. We got married in Louisville, Kentucky, and people from here and people from all over the country came. And I got to dance with my daddy. I got to make that amends to that man from when I was 13 years old. I got to dance with my daddy at my wedding. You know, I get to do those things today. You know, I get to come here, and this is the hardest thing that AA ever asks me to do, is to come and speak. You know, but I get to do that. I hear people say a lot that AA gave them their life back. But for me, what I realized is I never had a life. AA gave me a life. AA gave me relationships and friendships and a God of my understanding. It gave me a 10th step to do at night and 11th step to wake up with every single morning. Because every single morning, I wake up with untreated alcoholism. And what that means for me is every single morning, I wake up irritable, restless, and discontent. And if I don't spend time with my God and let Him direct my day, and I don't read my 84 through 88, and I'm not perfect, thank God this program doesn't require me, that of me, you know, and I'm not willing to accept where I'm at and those harms that I do on a daily basis, and I'm not willing to continue to grow with my God, I'm going to go backwards again. And I don't think I have another drink in me. So today I choose to accept what I'm offered, to be able to come here and treat my disease and be of service and be with you all in a wonderful, wonderful place like Monteagle. Thank you all.